Welcome to this episode of City Talks, where we'll be exploring the Northern Powerhouse. The term Northern Powerhouse was first used by George Osborne in a 2014 speech in Manchester and has continued to be a priority for the current government, getting a prominent mention in the Queen's speech and its own minister, James Wharton MP. Since then, there's been lots of debates about the reasons for the Chancellor's interest in the Northern Powerhouse, much of which have highlighted the political ambitions. But today's discussion is not going to focus on these political ambitions. We'll cover those in a future City Talks episode. Instead, we're going to focus on the economic and the policy issues associated with the term and what that means for future policy making. To explore these issues, my guests are Bridget Roswell, a founding partner of Volterra, former chief economist at the Greater London Authority; Mike Emmerich, founding director of Metro Dynamics and former chief executive of New Economy Manchester; and Neil Lee, assistant professor in economic geography at the London School of Economics. Welcome to my guests. Bridget, if I can turn to you first. The Northern Powerhouse is a new term, but actually the economic theory that underpins it is not new at all. Can you give us a sense as to what that theory is and how it relates to the Northern Powerhouse?
I think the fundamental thing is the recognition that cities, concentrations of people who work and have their being together, is a fundamental element in economic performance and indeed a fundamental driver of improvements in economic performance. So piece number one, cities matter. Why do cities matter? Cities matter because that's where people get together. And it's when people get together that they are able to do business with one another more effectively, they have new ideas, they can match jobs to people more easily, they can build businesses, access new markets, drive new markets. And I think particularly in periods of economic change, cities become even more important. So when computers were first invented, all computers operated in the centre of cities. There were systems analysts and people writing computer programs right in the centre of cities and doing things which now become much more spread out than normal business. They go off to back offices, they go off to India or China or wherever. So it's the new stuff and it's the new ideas that we need cities for. So that's point number one, cities matter. So what does that say about the Northern Powerhouse? The Northern Powerhouse is the idea that if we get the cities of the North to work more effectively together and essentially enable them to be one larger city, one and a half larger cities rather than disparate ones, they will be able to go up that curve of, the technical term is agglomeration, it's rather an ugly word, but what it basically means is enabling people to get together more effectively. Mm-hmm. So London obviously does it extremely well and has done it historically extremely well. And in the North, we've had cities which in history have also done it extremely well. Indeed, much of the theory of this was invented about Manchester in the days of King Cotton. That's where it all comes from. And the early economic theory is all a description of Manchester. But as the economy has changed and structural change continues, we need to make it possible for Manchester, for Leeds, for Sheffield, Liverpool, Newcastle, Hull, to work more effectively together. And that is the core idea. How we do that then becomes the challenge, of course. And that's not just a challenge about transport infrastructure. It's also a challenge about other forms of investment. It's a challenge about a local organisation. It's a challenge about devolution, actually, I believe. It's a challenge about how people do it for themselves and how they make changes for themselves. So it's not just an economic theory which says, though some economists do push it down this, transport does that, you have to have skills for the other, and it's all kind of chopped into different bits. I don't actually agree with that. And the whole point of cities is how you get the whole piece to work together and how you get all people and policies and enterprises and so on all in the right place at the right time.
Great.
It's a challenge.
Okay, so we'll come back to those sort of policy issues. So it's premised around that cities matter. And the Northern Powerhouse, is particularly, as you said, is about connecting some of those cities up. Neil, give us your take on additional elements you want to throw into the economic and theoretical underpinnings to the Northern Powerhouse.
So, Bridget sort of summed up very well the sort of standard economics of this, I guess. So one thing, if you're looking at how different countries have different patterns of cities, you can plot them according to the size of the cities. And this is an empirical regularity known as Zipf's law, where in most countries they obey a sort of certain distribution. So you have one very big city, one city which is quite a lot smaller, the next one sort of a certain amount smaller. And if you plot British cities on a sort of Zipf's law graph, it's not the, you know, given how big London is and given the size of our sort of smaller cities, it's actually the medium-sized cities which are too small. So this is Manchester, Leeds, Sheffield. You know, these don't seem like medium-sized cities to us, but in a sort of international context, they are. So actually it builds on this sort of this evidence base and this perception that these cities are too small. There is a sort of cautionary tale about the sort of agglomeration economies, which I think Bridget was sort of highlighting here, which is that it's a, you know, we know that from urban economics research that larger cities are more productive, but that doesn't mean that all productive cities are big cities, if you see what I mean. So it's not a universal law. So there's a sort of challenge there, and we see, you know, lots of medium-sized or small cities which are highly productive. And the other thing is that actually the things we know about agglomeration economies are pretty basic, you know, surprisingly basic given the sort of importance which we place on them in terms of policy. So, you know, if you think about Oxford, for example, highly productive, relatively small city, borough sort of agglomeration from London is one example. And so you can see these sort of, it starts to become quite fuzzy and quite messy when we think about agglomeration economies.
Yes, that's a term you referred to it as a fuzzy term, which we'll definitely come back to, particularly in a policy context. Mike, give us your perspective on the sort of underpinnings, and I think then it'd be good to get a reflection from you, given your involvement from Greater Manchester and beyond on the policy angle as to how, since we first heard it from the Chancellor, how the policy environment has evolved.
Listening to what we've just heard, I'm kind of, one of my immediate thoughts is, because there's been this huge row between geographers and economists about this, about whether the agglomeration story is right, how much of the story it is, and some work saying that actually, you know, this is just not as empirically valid as people say it is. One of my arguments against that flows immediately from what you just said, Neil, which is that I think there's something about the nature of deindustrialisation in the north of England in the last 40 years, allied to the spatial scale of England being such a small place to have so many cities, that kind of knock a lot of these normal relationships out of the water. Mm-hmm. I'd say the deindustrialisation of Britain in the last 40 years was a profound policy failure across the political spectrum of a kind that simply didn't play out in quite the same way in other countries, or certainly not with as disastrous consequences. Mm-hmm. And you can't look at the numbers we're seeing today without recognising that. And I think that's the context for what George Osborne's doing. I mean, yeah, I've heard politicians of every political party, you know, metaphorically taking their hats off to George Osborne for the boldness of his speech at the Museum of Science and Industry in June 2014 that kicked all this off. Mm. You know, I've heard a lot of good senior Labour people saying that was a speech that this country has needed for decades, and it's a shame that it didn't come sooner. So I think on the parts of people who've engaged with this, I think they see it as being something that's at very least in part positive. You know, there are undoubtedly political reasons for the Chancellor doing it, to do with his own ambitions and also the reputation of his party in the cities. I mean, where I grew up, if you said you were a Tory, it was a source for a fist fight.
Yep.
Because that was the nature of early 1980s northern cities.
Yep.
So he knows all that, but he's also basically bought, because of the work that Jim O'Neill did, hopefully the work of people like the Centre for Cities, New Economy, Bridget's consultancy, and Henry and his team at the LSE have done. I think him and the Treasury bought this agglomeration story for the first time. You know, they are prepared to believe for the first time that this is an issue which, if we get it right, could achieve some change on our national aggregates as a country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the context. The problem is that it's being launched into a world of utter cynicism about politics in general, utter cynicism among a lot of, you know, people in an essentially social democratic north of Britain about the motives of a Conservative Chancellor, and something of a policy vacuum. Yeah. Because outside of some stuff that you can kind of model around transport and skills, I think there's a lot of big unanswered questions about what exactly you do to make this Northern Powerhouse work.
Yeah. One of the big pieces in that, which I think is really important, and we saw it a lot when I was sitting on the City Growth Commission and indeed working with Jim and so on, is the importance of the devolution story. Mm-hmm. In other words, we have spent the failure, I think, of regional city and any other kind of policy that you care to mention in this space, is that we infantilised city governments and regional governments for 50 years.
Yeah.
And it was all about for a local area, it was all about showing what you needed to support social welfare and all the rest of it, and then going cap in hand and asking for it.
Mm.
And it was never about self-help, and it was never about giving people the power to go out and do it.
And of course, the economics of that. I mean, we all remember the days of regional selective assistance, where literally your incentive as a city was to go and bid with whatever crap project you had that you needed funding for to make sure the other guy didn't get the money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Rather
than to show how bad you were rather than how good you could.
It pushed you down to be bad. And I think the big thing that we've managed to achieve over the and agree about the Osborne speech, but actually there's a whole lot of other things that have gone on alongside that, including the establishment of the GLA, for example, and showing how that worked. And getting the argument for Crossrail across the line with the help of a mayor who could then bring all of that stuff together. That kind of increase in city confidence. And I actually think in Manchester, Richard Leese and Howard Bernstein being a kind of stable partnership and deciding that they needed to go out and do it for themselves and making that difference has brought finally... kicking and screaming has brought Whitehall to the table of devolution. And I think that we must not underestimate the importance of those features in giving people the confidence to go and do all the other things without which any investment is a waste of time.
You can certainly see how the sort of Northern Powerhouse is sort of has evolved from partly the sort of Manchester model of stable governance. And so I went and did a load of interviews with people, a lot of people, sort of senior people in Whitehall. And one of the things they said was simply Manchester is easy to do business with and they've proved that they can be trusted. So actually Manchester, over a long, long period of time, helped prove that local area, you know, they've helped sort of disprove the worst fears of the Whitehall bureaucrats in quite a nice way.
It took a long time, and later on
we've seen other cities and other sort of, you know, I guess sort of, you know, groupings of local authorities, you know, realise that this is the way to go, and this is the way that you can get a bit of sort of recognition, and you can start to get what you want from sort of local, well, from central government. There's a challenge for the Northern Powerhouse, though, which is that it sort of starts off being about Manchester, and it starts off about being this sort of stable government, which you can do, stable local government, which you can trust, this sort of city, which is sort of the archetypal resurgent city in the north of England. But then, you know, first of all, that it sort of spreads out within the north, so, you know, you have to give money to Tees Valley, you have to give money to the northeast, and it's very difficult to sort of, you know, it's very difficult to reconcile those two things. And also other areas need that.
But I think, to come in on that then, Mike, right? It'd be interesting to get your reflection. So I see the point about focusing in on Greater Manchester and trying to double down on some of the, you know, the improvements we've seen there. I see the arguments of doing that at the Greater Manchester level. I'm less clear now about why we need a Northern Powerhouse in order to have Manchester be more successful. And so say what you were going to say, Mike, but pick on this point about how Greater Manchester and its position relates to the Northern Powerhouse and the requirements for something that's more than just one city, which is what you were saying at the outset, Richard.
So I think what Neil's just said is 100% right on the politics of this, in that, you know, a variety, one of my standard talks, most of them start when I'm talking about my former employers in Manchester, is to say you have to remember that all the local authorities of Manchester are underbounded, and that the city has an obvious centre called Manchester, and that those two things make it different from nearly every other city in the north. And so there are some good reasons in the economic geography and the politics of the place why it was always further ahead. I can make the argument as a Mancunian that it was always more visionary and all the rest of it, but that's by the by. So I think Neil is absolutely right that because of those things and the very stable leadership and you know, brave decisions that they've taken over the years, Manchester has politically created the space within which others can follow. But the economic story, I think, is and always was different. You know, there's only one region of the country is a net exporter. It's the northeast. You know, it's an amazing success story in some areas. If you look at where the textiles industry is coming back, it's coming back as much in Yorkshire as it is in Greater Manchester. If you look at what's going on at Liverpool, with Liverpool 2 and the post-Panamax changes to the distribution of freight around the country, the economic story is a great deal more complex. For sure, Manchester's the biggest economy in the north. But the way to view this economically is the way the Victorians viewed it, which is it's a network of places, each with their functional specialisms, that are joined up in a system. And I think it's the system that failed, my original point about what George Osborne's trying to do. And it's a system that can and should be rebuilt in a 21st century way.
So, but the other thing about that is scale around those specialisms as well. Without being too, I mean, you know, as soon as people talk about specialisms, I get sector strategies.
Me too.
Please take that away. But the so there's a roughly, there's a bit under 500,000 people working in Greater Manchester. It just doesn't have enough scale on its own to take best advantage of all the opportunities, and indeed to create opportunities for people to want to stay and their partners to stay, so everybody can get the right kind of job. So you want to be able to live somewhere between Leeds and Manchester, and one of you's working in Leeds and one of you works in Manchester, and it's fine and it's easy, and there's enough sense of where your career could go to make it that you don't come down to London, as most of the people around this table probably did. So we need to try and make sure that skills and enterprise and energy stay up in those places. And that means that mix of, which is kind of going to be unpredictable where it goes, because there's lots of things happening, as the graphene story, as well as the Panamax story in Liverpool and so on. So making that mix possible so that you can think of a labour market of more like 1.2 million rather than just under 500,000 is actually one of the things that makes this a network of cities, which is then effective, and the whole is bigger than the sum of the parts.
And can I build on that? Because I think that is 100% right, and it opens the door to what I think is a much bigger question. Because the Northern Powerhouse is a good idea. The Northern Way wasn't a bad idea. The way the Northern Way was executed, I think, left something to be desired, and it's a bit too early to say for the Northern Powerhouse. Mm. Yeah, I think those of us who have taken the agglomeration approach to things, working with Henry and Neil and his colleagues, have got to acknowledge that the great strength that's given us as an approach to our cities leaves some big unanswered questions about the distributional impact of growth within cities. And that's something where the Northern Powerhouse has got something to say, important indirectly on the demand side, but it doesn't really address the fundamental supply side issues, which, to tease out in very detail, we have put, in my home city of Manchester, a tram line into Oldham and to Rochdale, and another one into Ashton, and bluntly, it is not yet having the effect on our economy, on changing the way people move around to work, that we need it to. Mm. If we're going to have a city region that is drawing on the incredible talent that's in those areas, but which for whatever cultural, skills, historic reasons, aren't yet seeing the benefits of working in the centre of Manchester. And those issues, if we really care about our changing our productivity numbers, and they're awful, and a lot of the awfulness is concentrated in the Northern Powerhouse cities, and a lot of that is going to be fixed by dealing with the labour market problems that so far our economic policies haven't yet given us all the answers to fixing.
There is always a problem that you want things to happen more quickly than they are in fact going to.
Indeed.
So it doesn't mean to say it was the wrong thing.
I am absolutely not saying that. I defend that to my dying breath.
But it takes a long while for people
bring Neil in on those sorts of issues, because one of the things that you've rightly questioned, which is the downsides of what you've termed the fuzzy concept, which means A, it can be defined by lots of people to mean lots of different things, which sometimes then prevents us from being really clear about what those priorities are and actually seeing some progress on some of the things that really, really matter. So just say a little bit more about your concerns about the fuzzy concept and how that plays out then into the agenda as we understand it. I'll maybe come back to some of those distributional issues later on.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that Mike's absolutely right on skills, basically. This is the sort of, if you read Osborne's speeches on the Northern Powerhouse, he lays out four ingredients. So devolution, transport, science and innovation and culture, and he sort of, has some policies which he sort of fits into these boxes. But the main driver of regional disparities is skills. And, if you think about this in two ways, you can think about it in terms of sort of high-skilled workers. So Bridget mentioned sort of people who both need to do specialist jobs, and that's really, really important. And if you do bring together the sort of northern cities to create some sort of functional labour market, I suspect you would in the long term let people who want to live there, who want to both, who are in a couple where they both do specialist jobs, it would give them a, better range of employment opportunities and allow them to, it would kind of start to address that problem. But what it really does is very little to address the sort of, the sort of vocational skills type element. And there are things in the devolution side of things, but it's really not a focus. And that's a problem for the powerhouse, because it's sort of, you know, it's hitting all these buttons, but none of the one, it's not hitting the single most important one.
The trouble is, I think that the skills, we talk about skills as if we provide the skills and then people go off and demand them. And it doesn't work like that.
Mm-hmm.
So people will acquire, A, the most important skills that people acquire, they acquire when they're working, and we measure it. We just don't measure most of the skills that are actually relevant. And secondly, people go and acquire these skills when they think it's worth them doing it.
Well, absolutely.
And you can have as many policies as you like, but if there aren't, they don't, you don't seem to be opening up those opportunities, then it's, you know, they go and do the course and then they go back on the dole. And it's just seen as part of that mechanism of working. And that, I think, is really one of the big challenges. And that means that you need the organisations and the enterprises and all of those. We know most businesses, most job creation is done by small businesses, mm-hmm. so we need to have the kind of optimism which encourages people to stay up in these cities and create those businesses, many of which will start at small scale.
So how will... leave it to whoever wants to come in first, Mike or Neil, to pick up on that point from Bridget. How do you envisage the Northern Powerhouse idea, and more particularly, I think, some of the details that are beginning to emerge? To what extent will they affect the demand side of the economy, you know, the entrepreneurial side, the innovation side of the economy, as much as the transport and supply side issues that you were talking about slightly earlier on? Neil?
Well, so, I mean, just on the... I mean, Bridget's made this important point, right, which is that in the long term, you would hope that by all of the actions which are taking place in the Northern Powerhouse would provide incentives for people to sort of upgrade their skills, basically. You know, if you're living in a town where there isn't a particularly thriving economy, then you might just not worry about sort of developing your skills. There's a sort of economistic argument there. But the second reason why I guess the Northern Powerhouse doesn't really address these skills issues is because you don't, and I think this is quite sensible in some ways, is that you probably don't want to devolve too quickly a public policy which isn't necessarily working all that well. So, you know, if you think in this country we're not great at sort of basic skills, we're not as good at vocational skills as other countries. So, you know, passing that down to the local level, there's a question that I think there's an important question there about whether or not that would be a sort of a poison chalice, a mandate for local areas to sort of, you know, simply fail. So I think there's a sort of issue there. You also mentioned this point around sort of innovation, and I think one of the important things about the Northern Powerhouse actually is this focus on innovation, because, you know, simply the north of the country has got some of the best universities in the world. These universities have done historically very, very well. There's a sort of important question about whether they could be doing more than they are, and there's a sort of a general concern that basically science money is, you know, increasingly being focused in the Golden Triangle, London, Oxbridge, and actually, one of the nice things about the Northern Powerhouse as a concept is that it gives people an excuse to sort of spread money a little bit more widely. But the money really isn't, you know, it's not that much money which is being spread.
Quite.
So if you look at the Henry Royce Centre for Materials Research, I think it's about £230-235 million. And this is really nice, but it's sort of spread out across the north. And you compare that to the Crick Centre, which I think is in King's Cross, which is about sort of...
A comparison that Sir Mark Walpole doesn't like to hear.
Exactly. And, you know, that's £600 million, and it's just focused in the south. So it's a sort of very, there's still a sort of very uneven playing field in these areas.
So
that's actually quite important, because the numbers concern in some of these policies, as you say, when you make a London comparison with the total of the north, you suddenly think there is a scalar difference.
Yes. I think Neil's again absolutely right about that. You know, I think our policy of allocating science money is great in principle and dreadful in practice. You know, I challenge anybody to show me that what we've got is a truly meritocratic distribution of science research income by the talent of our various universities and researchers. The problem is principally a government problem in this country, not a private sector problem, though it's becoming a private sector problem because the government is having investment is so biased. And I absolutely agree that the money that we've talked about in the context of the Northern Powerhouse for science isn't enough, but it's a down payment. And frankly, it's better than we got most years under previous administrations.
Absolutely.
And a supertanker might just be turning here. That's the optimistic way of viewing it, and it's the way I usually choose to view it, because change generally happens in this country at the margins. But I want to take us back to kind of the wider labour market question, because I'm doing a bit of research, actually largely for the entertainment. One of the things that really strikes me is, you know, the city that we're in now, London, that was, seen globally as a basket case in the 1970s. You know, two of the very early investments in the cycle of its renewal were the opening of the Victoria Line in, I think, 1968, and the Jubilee Line a decade later. You know, those were massive, massive investments. Mm. And I think you can see those in the beginnings of the change in London, because, and they were massive investments. And I just compare that, you know, the whole of the expansion of Phase 3 of Metrolink, which built three new lines, cost less than the refurbishments of three London tube stations at Bank, Farringdon and Green Park.
So are you saying there, Mike, that at the heart, if at the heart of making the Northern Powerhouse successful, notwithstanding what others have said around skills and entrepreneurship and all the rest of it, is we need to invest now in upgrading the quality of the transport infrastructure as an enabling agent for those sorts of things?
I am absolutely saying that, but there's a very, very clunking big but about to come in. I've just finished a piece of work for the London Borough of Barking and Dagenham, an independent review that I've led. And, you know, what that found is that of course, Barking Dagenham is the area where Ford are still there with a few thousand workers, but used to have a lot of thousands more.
Yeah.
The sad fact is that even in this city, you know, with half an hour away from the West End of London, with a six-minute tube service of the District Line, there are thousands of men, and they are largely men, who used to work at Ford, who never found another well-paying job. And if they did, the statistics of their families are as bad, broadly speaking, as if they haven't found a job. I think what is at the heart of this is something about urban change, sectoral change, communities, and our ability to get policies in place that enable people to live happy, fulfilling, successful, moderately well-paying lives at least in cities as they change. And we got it wrong in Greater London. Issues like Ford and the docks, we got it wrong in the north in the next 40 years. And the opportunity of the Northern Powerhouse and of devolution is to start to innovate some ideas that will deal with those problems. Because what is sure is that the welfare state, a lot of people, particularly on the left, you know, will die in a ditch to defend, did not actually help those families very well at all.
Bridget, yeah, another very good point.
What you can't do is just turn the clock back.
No.
You can't say, and actually this is one of the policy mistakes which got us into this mess, was trying to support ineffective and unprofitable businesses and keep them going, rather than enabling change actually to take place. So,
well, we're having those conversations today, aren't we?
So, and even in Oxford, for example, I mean, Oxford used to have lots of car plants in it.
Yep.
In the days of my radical youth, I went and sold radical newspapers outside them, but they're not there now. I hope I'm not responsible for that too directly. But all of that is now a business park, and all of that has now changed. There's very different people working in them, of course, and there's the transition as those people lost. There actually are still some car plants in Oxford, but as those jobs disappeared, how do you manage those transitions? How do you encourage people to take up new opportunities, or protect them if they're unable to take up those opportunities?
But my point, I think,
but what you can't do is say the world mustn't change.
Well, I'm not.
And I know you're not.
I'm absolutely not saying that. But the problem is our politics is starting to say exactly that. I think that's exactly what the rise of Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party is about. I think it's exactly what the rise of UKIP is about. Let's turn the clock back and go to a different and theoretically, but not practically, better age. And I suspect if you go to the Blackbird Lees estate in Oxford, I suspect you will find people quite like the people I was talking about in Barking that you're seeing in spades in Oldham and Rochdale.
And they're in Oldham and Rochdale as well. And they don't, they want the world to go back to where it was before. You can understand why they would. Unfortunately, that world doesn't exist.
So I think the job for all of us is to work out what are the innovations, what are the ideas, we've got to remake this, not try and pretend.
I completely agree with that, and I know Neil wants to come in. I'm going to try and push you to then reflect on what is it in response to those challenges. What does the Northern Powerhouse allow us to do differently, or in addition to what we should and could be doing at the Greater London level, or the Greater Manchester level, or the Greater Leeds level, or at the reverse, at the very local neighbourhood level? What's the you know, what's the heart of, at the heart of the Northern Powers is an idea that we can do more than or different from what we do at the city level or the greater city level. Neil?
So, I mean, I guess there's sort of, there's a couple of sort of interesting things about the Northern Powerhouse, which I think help it in a way which sort of normal local government structures, however successful or however good they are, sort of can't do. One is that it's got like a lot of name recognition. So there was a survey out a couple of weeks ago. 51% of people in the north had heard of the Northern Powerhouse or claimed to have heard of the Northern Powerhouse. Third of people in the Midlands. You know, if you ask them about whether they'd heard of the work programme or even combined authorities, they probably wouldn't have much of a clue. So it's quite a nice sort of policy brand from that point of view. And I think that's useful. It's been useful for sort of marketing the north internationally. But the second, and I guess this sort of goes back to something Mike said earlier, is this sort of strategic role of the Northern Powerhouse. So, you know, the Northern Powerhouse has this strong sort of branding, political branding element, and I sort of, you know, have to accept that that happens. But there is also a sort of grain of sort of strategic approach in it, which I think is quite useful. I mean, we talked about science and science funding being made based according to the, I think, the Haldane, I'm not sure, principle about how you fund the best research wherever it's located. And similarly, there's sort of principles in terms of sort of transport funding, which suggests that you fund basically, you know, if you just want to fund areas which are congested, all the money would go to roads projects in the southeast. And that's basically the sort of standard cost-benefit analysis approach. And what the Northern Powerhouse helps, I guess, policymakers do is it gives them something of a sort of strategic vision to allow them to make these sort of investments, like Bridget said about the Victoria Line, but sort of similarly in a sort of northern context. Now, there's a sort of secondary question here, which is the extent to which they're actually doing that and the extent to which they're backing it with enough money and the way in which the sort of policies are being enacted. But I think the Northern Powerhouse does actually have some sort of strategic merit. Part of that is because it's such a strong brand.
Yeah, yeah. Mike, what does it allow us to do that just working at the Greater Manchester or the Greater Leeds or the Greater Liverpool level scale doesn't allow us or enable us to do?
I think it's significant in the realms of politics. You know, most of my working life, whether it was when I was a civil servant, and I heard it from colleague civil servants when I was back in Manchester, arguing with those civil servants, how many times did I hear we can't make policy, national policy for Manchester? We can't do it. Mm-hmm. And if what this is sort of taking some of the stuff from Manchester and some of the stuff from Newcastle and Sunderland and the other places, Hull, whatever, in the north, and saying, you know, all of these places has genes, it's got a history, it's got a trajectory. If each of these places concentrates on being the best it can, we can recreate this notion of a vibrant northern economy and not one we just tell jokes about on the pages of Private Eye. Mm. I think the political consequences of that, there was a very good article in Private Eye a couple of weeks ago that I'm referring to, actually, that the north is moving south because it's in an inconvenient location. That's kind of our country. The political kind of impetus that comes from that is in itself very, very important. I think the most important thing that they can follow in from that is that, you know, within a couple of years, we're going to have a group of very, very important elected mayors. Mm. I think it's more likely that these large city regions and regions that are electing will return people of real experience and substance. And I think once you've got those people, and those people see themselves as part of a thing, a movement, a combination of Northern Powerhouse, Midlands Engine, because there'll be one in the West Midlands, of course, as well. You know, they will see themselves with devolution. They will, and the possibility of more devolution. They will see themselves as important national figures who can start to apply pressure to national government. Mm. Can use their devolved resources to show that Whitehall really doesn't know best, and actually Whitehall very often doesn't know well at all. Mm-hmm. I think that it could, if everybody stays true to what we're trying to do. National government devolving, the city's doing the right thing, I think could change the politics of England, possibly forever, and certainly for the better.
So that's a little bit about, if I'm hearing you right, about, I'd be interested in your reflection as to how much, you know, those in the Northern Powerhouse, they currently feel that the Northern Powerhouse as an idea is theirs, or it's, you know, it's the Chancellor's, and whether, in order for it to be real and to be impactful over time, we would have to have a sense of ownership amongst, you know, the urban areas and the leaders of those places, in the sense that the Northern Powerhouse is something that they can use for their own gains rather than have it done to them by Chancellor.
That's a good question. I mean, you know, I think the government has shot itself badly in the foot. You know, I'm not going to try and pretend to you that the Biz office in Sheffield was the most important office of government. But to that decision taken without due thought about how it would play, the same week as they decided that the National Photographic Collection would go from Bradford to the V&A, was just stupid.
Yeah.
It was plain stupid. And I think things like that just feed the cynicism on the parts of a lot of backbench members of councils, certainly large numbers of the policy community and political activists, that this is just a stitch-up by the Tories who don't really care about the North.
Yeah.
It's much more than that. And I think the leaders of parties know it can be much more than that. But it's in the balance. And I think there's a lot of hard work, a lot of spending decisions to be taken that show that there's more resource for things that are really going to add value to our economy in the North, and the need for some better politics too.
Yeah,
but it does depend upon the willingness of those mayors as they get elected to get up on the plate and to shout the case.
For sure.
And also shout the case, not that, you know, it's our turn, we must have.
For sure.
But to shout the case that invest here, it pays back. And that's, I think, it was absolutely, when we got a mayor for London, and the existence of a mayor was supported not just by policymakers, but by business community and everything else, and then you could have those core campaigns, then, you know, you had the scale and the weight to stand up to Whitehall, basically.
Yep.
And that's what we need the group for, and that's why it's not just about Greater Manchester. Absolutely. Greater Manchester can only take you so far.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting enough scale and enough agreement and pulling together, and that's the big risk here, enough pulling together that you can really stand up to Whitehall on the policy front, but also put it out there, as it were, on the international front.
I was going to say, how important is this sort of brand? Yeah.
There are only two runway airports in this country. One's at Heathrow, and the other is in Manchester.
Yep.
So, you know, the scope for doing international business out of Manchester, if you begin to get that flywheel turning, is massive.
Mm. Exactly right.
There's only two.
Yeah. And presumably, having that sort of brand, which is well recognised and has real scale and heft underneath it, so it's not just
nothing over with this underneath.
Yeah.
You know, they don't actually exist in
It's very important internationally, in the sense of being able to communicate a set of understandings.
And I think that's why I think powerhouse is actually a better term than way.
Yep.
Which made you think that you were sort of driving from Liverpool to Hull and then you'd fall into the sea, or vice versa.
But there is a danger with this sort of brand, right? Which is that, you know, we've seen other policy brands like the Big Society, where, you know, I'm sure there were sort of podcasts done with people who worked in the charitable sector talking about how great the Big Society was as a sort of idea. And actually, like Mike says, you know, this can then sort of, you know, once you have a brand, it, you know, it needs to have something behind it, but also it's kind of vulnerable. You know, if they move another government department from the North, or, you know, we saw it with the flooding, for example, where it becomes something which you can attack and which the media can attack.
But that doesn't, I agree with that critique, but doesn't that pick up then on Mike's point about who owns the brand,
In
the sense that if not, it seemed to me that no one owned a Big Society brand other than the Prime Minister, and therefore, you know, when his attention turned to other things, it dwindled on the vibe. Whereas the Northern Powerhouse, if it's owned by,
it has to be owned by,
you know, the places, particularly the big places in the North, there's a better chance of doing
that. It's not done by Whitehall. The economic development in London wasn't done by Whitehall either.
Well, they'd like to think that it is.
Of course, they'd like to think it is, but even when Mike was in the Treasury, he still really wasn't. It's not how it works. It works with individual firms and businesses and so on, and then a local and deep devolved policy which supports that, and planning policies which support it.
So I want to just turn us a little bit to, and I'm, you know, mindful, as we said, at least the term has not been around for very long, even if the rationale and the underpinnings for it have been around for considerably longer. But as in terms of the Northern Powerhouse as a policy idea, what do we really need to be thinking about next? What do we need to be doing, Mike, in order for the cynicism and the concerns not to outweigh the, you know, the possibilities and the potential? And what do we need to be doing? And I guess it goes back to this issue of ownership. Who needs to be doing that?
So I think there are three groups of people, I think, who probably matter in this space. Firstly, let's start with the government, as it's their idea. The government has got to keep doing the right things. It's got to listen to what the Infrastructure Commission is saying, what's going on rail in the North, It's got to listen to what the combined authorities and the emerging mayors are saying, and it's got to respond with sensible devolutionary policy. I'm sure that this country could balance sheet could withstand more infrastructure investment for things that were really value adding, and that's any scope for manoeuvre has got to be used in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also got to stop doing daft things of a kind that I talked about mm-hmm. a minute ago. So that's for the government.
Yeah.
For the cities, the business leaders, the civic leaders need to stand firm to keep on pushing. Keep on thinking hard. You know, I think the biggest risk in this area is a lack of big ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not many people have done what Peel Holdings have done, whether or not you agree with their Ocean Gateway, Atlantic Gateway ideas. There's not many people who've done what Manchester have done with graphene. There are a few really good ideas came out of work we saw in the North East and elsewhere that could and should be given a better hearing next time, but there certainly aren't enough to close these GVA gaps.
Mm.
You know, business and civic leaders have just got to get you know, carry on getting the discussions going that generate the ideas, that generate the things that will make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And then thirdly, somewhere in this are the people of the North, because I think they are left behind, and I think that's true on devolution. I spoke at a debate that I organised through our Discuss events in Manchester on Wednesday night, which was split down the middle on this subject, mm-hmm. where devolution to Manchester was democratically flawed. I think there's a battle out there for ideas in which, you know, the world where you know, where Tinseltown and everything, a film that comes out of America believes that all governments are conspiracy, infects our public life. And people are too ready to believe that it's all just a stitch up and it's not for them and it's a conspiracy.
Yes.
And I think the fact that they're not engaged enough yet in any of these debates can only lead that to be worse. So I think somewhere in this is engaging people too.
Neil, give us some thoughts.
So, I mean, it's so very well for sort of people like me who are sort of cynical academics to sort of be sceptical about the sort of Northern Powerhouse. But I guess, I mean, Mike sort of nailed it when he talked about ownership, because it's the only game in town, really. And, you know, if you're a Northern city region, then you've got to be involved in it. I guess if you're a city region in the West Midlands as well, you've got to be sort of using it. You've got to be coming up with big ideas, and you've got to be using it as a way of sort of holding the government to account for their sort of spending decisions. And I think it's quite useful from that perspective. But, you know, just what, I mean, one thing which we haven't touched on here, right, is that this is the Northern Powerhouse is relatively small amounts of money against the backdrop of large cuts in public spending, particularly in certain parts of the country.
Parts of cuts everywhere in the
country. Everywhere.
But the devolution hasn't made those any worse. But it's certainly not very much money in comparison with them.
So, you know, so it's a sort of, it's going to be difficult for Northern councils, however, you know, however good they are, however stable, however good their ideas are, to sort of get this off the ground in these sort of, in these difficult times.
Bridget, give us your thoughts on what we need to be doing now
There's some very specific things, and kind of one of the things on the skills front is for Whitehall to get out of the way on the 16 to 19 year olds. Where they will not let go.
They just won't.
So then that takes you all into the apprenticeship and the vocational end of things, and the getting specific policies for specific locations, and they won't let go of that. So I think that's very damaging. From a central government point of view, for the North, ensuring that Transport for North gets a good run, you know, to get itself established. It's very new. Its chairman was only appointed about a month ago. It's got to produce a report before the budget. Of course, the Infrastructure Commission is also doing things in the same space to try and make sure that they do get that clear run. I think is actually quite challenging. There are 30, it's got a staff of a dozen, I believe, but there are 30 people in the Department for Transport checking up on it all the time. So again, how does that work in devolution terms? So for me, actually, a lot of getting Northern Powerhouse to work is getting Whitehall off the pitch. You just keep trying and plugging away at it, I guess. Getting them to give up on some of the things that they continue to want to be in charge of. And only then will people be able to step up to the plate and run it. Whitehall keeps saying, oh, well, you know, are they up to it? Yeah, da, da, da. Well, if you continue to say that, they never will.
Well,
yeah, it's infantilisation. If you don't let the children out into play, they'll never learn how.
But the problem is the absence of a counterfactual in so many of these policy areas, because Whitehall controls all the budgets. But I'd simply
point to our productivity statistics to say that our skills system can't be working that well, our transport system can't be working that well, and job entry rates from the work programme in single digits or a bit better, which suggests that welfare to work ain't working that well either. Oh, and by the way, the NHS is bust. So a bit of devolution might just be a good thing.
The failures of a very centralised system become ever more apparent on a daily basis.
The only linkages between all of these things is at a local and city, regional level.
Great.
You can't do it nationally.
No.
It just does not work.
And on that note, my guests today have been Bridget Roswell, Mike Emmerich and Neil Lee. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by the Centre for Cities. We're an independent, non-partisan think tank dedicated to understanding and improving city economies. For more on our research and events programme, including our extensive back catalogue, please visit our website, centreforcities.org.